Blog Talk Radio.
You are listening to the McCarthy Project live from Minnesota, where we have been attacking life and sports since 2001. Good afternoon, this is Stephen McCarthy from the McCarthy Project, and we are coming to you from Minneapolis, Minnesota. And we are, over the last couple of weeks, have been discussing the idea of the Human Genome Project, sports genes, every other form of genetics over the last 50 years to find some semblance of what is reality when it comes to pursuit of elite performance in sports, and is everybody, if you don't have the genes, do you not get to succeed? Or is it the other way around, where everybody has the opportunity to succeed if they just so choose? So today we're going to continue that discussion with Daniel Coyle. He is a best-selling author of numerous books, of which one today we're going to be talking about the Talent Code. And how you doing today, Daniel?
Pretty good, Stephen. Thanks. How you doing?
Doing well. Doing well. But before we go into the particulars, how did you come across the Talent Code or the subject of genetics in sports or practice? Or how did you come across the subject, and what was kind of your motivation for writing the book?
Yeah, it's interesting. I came across a newspaper clip about 5-6 years ago, and it talked about a Russian tennis club outside of Moscow named Spartak that had produced more top 20 players than the entire United States. I got kind of interested in that, and I started looking at other hotbeds. And when you start looking for other hotbeds, you find them. I mean, we're familiar with all the baseball players that come from a tiny town in the Dominican Republic. There's hotbeds in chess. There's hotbeds in dance. There's hotbeds in music. There's hotbeds in basketball. And so when you look at those, there are certain. I went and visited about 9 of them. And I looked into the brain science. I spent a lot of time looking at the brain science of learning, how we get good at stuff. And there's a pattern that recurs over and over in these places. And that pattern exists because when the human brain gets good at stuff, and all, you know, we use the name muscle memory, but in fact, there really is no such thing as muscle memory. You know, all the skills, whether it's a golf swing or a tennis swing or a high jump, those are built, the skill part of it is built in the brain. The technique part of it is built in the brain. Our muscles are essentially pretty dumb. So so looking at those patterns and seeing where they connect, and it turns out that they are all practicing in a similar way, they're being motivated in a similar way, and they're being coached in a similar way. And so that pattern is what the book is all about. And essentially it's about trying to build your life in a way that you are replicating what they're doing at the Talent Hotbeds.
You know, and it's an interesting, I guess, philosophical question, more so than anything, is that do you feel that there is one path, or are there, because you've always heard the old axiom that, you know, there's more than one way to skin a cat, or there's more than, you know, there's more than one way to get from A to B, you know, that type of a question. Do you feel that there really is one path, or is it a general path that you walk down that we're using, and it just happens to be close? They're not the same, but they're close.
Yeah, because what I saw and what I reported on was that there really is a path that we all share. And that path leads through the territory of intensive practice, what I call in the book deep practice. That's when you're operating on the edge of your ability, making mistakes, failing, and then reaching again. And when you're doing that, you're making new connections in your brain. Now, do genes matter? Absolutely. They absolutely matter. But when you really look at the science, they matter a lot less than we presume. They matter a lot less than we think. For any complicated skill, you know, the rule of 10,000 hours does hold. any complicated skill, and that's because to spend time on the edge of your ability, you are constructing a faster and better brain. And when you look at the behaviors of people from Peyton Manning to Wayne Gretzky, all across the board, what they share is that they've spent time on the edges of their ability over and over and over again. Now, genes still do matter when it comes to really, really raw athletic skills, no question. And they really matter if you're at the top 0.001%. They matter quite a bit if you want to win a marathon. They matter quite a bit if you want to win a 100-meter sprint. But for most of us, in most of our lives, who are worried about making the hockey team, who are worried about getting a scholarship, you can't change your genes. What you can change is your practice environment. And when you do change your practice environment, there are massive, and I tell the story in the book over and over again, of these massive performance benefits that happen when you slightly alter the practice space.
You know, it's interesting when you talk about, because I think, you know, I'm 45 years old, and Wayne Gretzky is probably the epitome of what we're talking about, of living on the edge of your talent. Being from Minnesota, I was a hockey, you know, I'll say I'm a hockey fan. I wasn't like some all-in kind of guy, but I remember watching him, and he would skate, and he'd look funny. He was always slow. He never could go faster than everybody else, but he always saw something that somebody else didn't see. And that resides in the brain and how you view what's happening or what's occurring. How do you, when you live on the edge, what changed when you lived on the edge? In Wayne Gretzky's case, was it his vision? Was it his brain? How did he practice it?
He built himself a very good brain. Actually, he used to sit in front of the television, and his father would hand him a piece of paper and a pencil. And his father's instructions were, trace every place the puck goes. Trace it on the paper. See that. He developed the ability, and we call it a soft skill, where you are recognizing, reacting, and anticipating. It's not magic. It's like he just has a brain that is attuned to a slightly different set of signals because it spent a lot of time staring at it, making mistakes, staring at it some more, figuring out those patterns. And it's not only mental, it's also physical. When he would skate, when he would practice, he would occasionally fall down. He'd be by himself, skating moves, and his teammates would see this puzzling sight of Wayne Gretzky tipping over and falling down. That's because he knew he needed to go to the edge and a little bit past it in order to get better. So we all are familiar with the athletes, the brilliant prodigies who are the best when they're 12, and they're the best when they're 13. But it turns out when you look at the science, those guys are not usually the best when they're 20. They're not, because they get in a comfort zone and they stop pushing themselves to be uncomfortable. And they get out of what psychologists would call the sweet spot. The sweet spot of learning is when you're succeeding about 60 to 80% of the time. That's it, just 60 to 80, not 90 and not 50. But you're in an area where you're making it two-thirds of the time. That's when learning happens, and that's where Wayne Gretzky spent his time. That's where Peyton Manning spends his time. That's where improvement happens. And so whether you're a prodigy or whether you're the undersized kid who's not getting picked, the most powerful thing you can do is increase the amount of time you spend in the sweet spot.
Now let's go off into a couple other areas, because there are always, you know, we talk about the general – path, if you will, but there are ways to make that path work better, i.e. training, nutrition, sleep. How big of influence outside of developing this path, this sweet spot, are those pieces involved?
Well, they're big. I mean, they're definitely big, you know, especially sleep. You know, it's a massive. A lot of learning happens when you're asleep, and that's one of the most powerful things I saw when I was visiting these talent hotbeds. They're very talented nappers, whether they're musicians, basketball players, hockey players. They sleep a lot. And it kind of cuts against, I think a lot of modern practice tends to push kids over and over again into exhaustion, to have these long, long practices. That's not how the talent hotbeds do it. That's not the ideal way to do it. The ideal way to do it is with short, really intense practices followed by a lot of rest, a lot of sleep. There's a good experiment going on now with the Philadelphia Eagles. The coach, Chip Kelly, there is monitoring the players' sleep. He's monitoring their hydration. He's monitoring their nutrition. He's trying to really tune them into those other factors of health that, that really do matter when it comes to getting better.
It is an interesting discussion because they're always, I call it the random hardcore workout, but they, with the idea that a parent now has access to training information, and they have always been told that if you work harder, you'll be better, you know, and they combine this little bit of information on a training program with the idea of working hard, and they think more is better. And you see a lot of injuries taking place. A lot of people aren't able to recover and think through things because they're just having to survive. What happens when you fog your brain with all these survival instincts? How does it affect your ability to stay in the sweet spot?
Look, pushing yourself to exhaustion is good. It builds emotional skills, so it's good in that way. But you do not, an exhausted brain is not a brain that can learn new skills. If you are trying to learn new technique, if you are trying to get people to perform at their best, practicing when you're exhausted is an absolutely terrible method. And you see over and over again, the best soccer players on the planet come out of Barcelona. They have a place called La Masia there, where kids, classic soccer academy, they only practice about 150 minutes a week. They don't practice much at all compared to their compatriots in the U.S., compared to their correspondents in the U.S., but they practice very intensely. And when they're away from it, they have a lot of play time and a lot of time to be creative. But no, this idea that you should behave like a soldier and push yourself till exhaustion and past it is really antithetical to learning.
It is really, because it's like I'm agreeing. It's funny because I didn't realize that I have come down over the last couple of weeks. I started to read a book called, funny because you Rupert, his name. It's funny how you don't do this on the radio, right? You don't ever think about something you didn't think of ahead of time. Science Set Free. Rupert Spreadlake. Do you know the book I'm talking about?
I don't.
Oh, it's called Science Set Free. I apologize everybody for not saying the name of it, but it's Science Set Free is the name of it. And basically what he's saying is exactly what you're saying. This guy's educated at Cambridge University and has done everything smart in his life. You're one of those kind of guys and talks with big words. And he's realized that a lot of the things that we hold as assumptions that were truth are really turned into dogmas, and they turn into fallacies because they're not 100% true. And so we base our whole life upon the science of something. And if we don't have the genetics, if we don't have, we're not 6'4", we just say, well, I can't do it because science says I can't. You see what I'm saying? Where he's saying the opposite. You need to get over into what he called the non-physical, which is 96% of the world, only 4% is the physical. So he's saying exactly what you're saying. Get over into this non-physical world, develop your skills, and it will happen in the natural.
Right. Well, it's funny. That reminds me of a story that I tell in the book, The Talent Code. And it's the story of someone practicing. Her name is Clarissa, and she's practicing the clarinet. And they filmed her practice. She was part of this big experiment that filmed her practice for many years, and they were able to identify the moments where her performance just took off, where her practice was incredibly effective, where she had this, there's a great term, it's called learning velocity, where her learning velocity just went through the roof. And so they captured on tape, and it's fascinating because what it looks like is she's playing clarinet, and then she makes a mistake, and she feels that mistake. She just plays the piano, she feels that mistake. It's like there's electricity being shot through the keys of the clarinet. And then she goes back, and she hums the notes. And you can almost see the wires of her brain glowing as they're struggling and reaching and reaching and reaching for this target. And then she goes back and plays a few more, and she makes another mistake, and she feels that mistake. And it sounds terrible when she plays it. It's sort of fitful and broken up, and she's struggling. They calculate her learning velocity goes up 10 times in that time. She accomplishes a month's worth of practice in 5 minutes. So this idea that we have of natural ability being effortless and that you're sort of born with it, talent is more of a construction project. And it's a construction project that depends on moments like Clarissa's, where you are on your edge, you're absolutely committed, you're reaching for something you can't quite get. And coaches and players who are able to create spaces where they can over and over again reach for something they can't quite get are the ones who are going to be constructing their skills, literally constructing them. And that's the exciting part to me, because it really does. I think our ideas about where talent comes from are, as you say, you know, sort of misguided. And when we tune into how it actually works, and we kind of align our behavior with the way brains actually get fast and the way skills actually get built, it makes for a happier life. You can sort of feel like you can control things more. I coached Little League for many years, and I coached it badly because I didn't really understand how to connect to kids and get them to the edge of their abilities. And when I started researching this topic, it was just like, you know, the scales fell from my eyes. I felt like, oh, this is what teaching is, you know, or this is how to do it. It was really one of the most gratifying things I've ever done is coaching these kids, because you can really see them grow.
Well, see, and the thing that's interesting, I got two things that come to mind when you're telling the story, is that Harvey Pinnick was the big golf coach, Tom Kite, Ben Crenshaw. You know, a long time ago. And he would never have them in the same coaching session, because he always had an individual message for that particular person. And he really felt that you taught the game of golf by feel, not by whether your elbow is in the right spot, your knee is in the right spot, this is in the right spot, this is in the right spot, because that'll give me 3% more power and all this kind of stuff. It was what worked well for you, and did you develop that feel so that you could repeat it and that you could do it under pressure? Now, this is another question, too, because I just thought about that. Under pressure, so now you've developed this ability to produce the results that you want. Now you're going in under pressure. What have your research shown related to pressure?
The guys that are the people who are able to produce under pressure are the ones who practice under pressure. Pressure is an emotional condition, and those who learn to control their emotions are ones who pre-create the pressure. You know, a good musician getting ready for a massively pressureful concert will pre-create that. They'll put on the same tuxedo they'll be wearing. They'll sit in the same chair that they'll be sitting in, and they will force themselves to go through the whole program without stopping. That's a great way to pre-create pressure. So I think you see the way to get better under pressure is to pre-create those conditions and to do it over and over again until you're teaching your brain to handle those emotions. Yeah, it's hard to fully replicate those things, but you see it happening a lot in the NFL. The way I go back to Chip Kelly and the Philadelphia Eagles, he and John Wooden, the way they would practice with huge speed, crowd noise, pressure, so that by the time you got to the game, it actually felt sort of slow and leisurely.
Yeah, because it's interesting, because I've heard the terms "the game slowed down for you." And I think these are some become kind of overused after a while, you know. But really, the essence of success at a high level is that you are able to see things at a faster pace than others. And is it come back into the pressure of the moment because they practiced it? Because this is now this. I'm sorry. Another question comes up. Because you could sit there and see, okay, I'm a young person with all the texting and social media and TV and music going on. There are so many random thoughts going through their mind. How would you teach a young person to start to slow their brain down, to start to focus in areas that seem boring after a while?
And that's you're really speaking to, I think, the role of a master coach. You know, kids today are hard to reach. Like, I think kids have always been probably pretty hard to reach, but it seems even more so today. And, you know, what I saw and what the research shows is that the most important person in that whole ecosystem, in that environment, is the coach. And their great skill isn't necessarily technical knowledge. It's the emotional ability and the communication ability to connect with one person at a time, like your Harvey Pinnick did. Connect with that one person at a time to get access to their heart and to their emotions. And when you find somebody like that, if there's a coach like that who really can capture people's hearts, I mean, that is an immensely, immensely powerful asset in the talent construction business. And as a parent, There's a great psychologist named Carol Dweck who once said, as a parent, you only have to do two things: pay attention to what your kid stares at, and praise them for their effort. And I think that really speaks to, I think, a lot of modern parenting seems to be organized around hustling your kid around to try all these different things. But if you slow down a little bit and really pay deep attention to what your child stares at, I mean, to stare at something would just send a very powerful signal about being fascinated and loving something. And that's where all talent begins, with that kind of fascination and love of the act, whether it's hitting a baseball or whether it's lifting weights or whatever it is, that fascination. And so to be tuned into when that happened and to seek out coaches who have that ability is sort of the most powerful thing you can do, because you can't force that stuff. You can't force attention. You can't force motivation. You have to create the conditions for it. And that's what master coaches do, and that's what smart parents do.
Done. All right, in the last couple of minutes, anything else that you could think of that people kind of would need to know to get started? And then I'm already going to tell you, I'm going out and recommend everybody get your book right now, because this is the essence of what I see life, is that life is not in the X's and O's. It's in your heart, in the love of something, in an understanding that goes beyond an X's and O's scenario. But anyways, last couple of minutes, anything else that you've got to share?
There was a cool thing I came across the other day, actually. It was a couple of coaches who've studied and worked with kids for many years, and they did a sort of an informal survey, and they asked the kids they worked with, who were about in college age, they said, what were the most positive and negative comments that your parents made to you? What things did you sort of dread the most, and what things did you find the most powerful? And the results were fascinating. On the negative side, the most negative thing was the ride home after the game, when the parents would sort of get involved and maybe ask questions, or why didn't you play as much, or did you guys hustle as much as you should? And that conversation, I think, as a parent, we've all had, where we try to kind of insert ourselves into the discussion, and we try to maybe offer some coaching and get involved. The kids absolutely hated that. What did they love? They loved this one sentence that parents would say. And the sentence that they loved is this: I love to watch you play. Six words. That was the sentence that the kids found the most meaningful. And I think there's a really powerful lesson there. Our role as parents is not to be coaches. Our role as parents is not to be their boss or their supervisor or to sort of judge their efforts at recreation. This is sports, after all. This isn't their career. This should be fun. Rather, our role as parents is to express our support, I think, and our unconditional support, to say, I just love to watch you play. I would rather watch you play tennis than watching Wimbledon. I think is a great reminder of really what the core of this is all about, because it's, you know, most of our kids are not going to play pro sports. Most of our kids are not going to ever get paid for this. What they are trying to do is build relationships, have some fun, learn some life lessons about resilience and toughness and cleverness. And so as a parent, it was I really found that to be moving, those six words. And so it's six words that I'm definitely going to – I'm definitely at the top of my mind these days.
Wouldn't agree more. I one of the greatest things was I was told a version of that same story that said basically after the game is over, it's not your job to be the coach. You know, it's just not the time for it. The other thing that I was told one time that I'll piggyback right on this is my job as a parent is to make sure my kids still like the sport when they get to high school.
Yeah.
Because we can ruin it really, really fast. All right. For all our listeners, if you want to get a hold of Daniel, it's at thetalentcode.com, all spelled out. He's got the links. He's got four or five other books, as well as writes for Outside Magazine. Tremendous, tremendous. Thank you very much, Daniel, for taking the time today.
My pleasure, Stephen.